Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Question: when you already own the banks, how do you regulate them?
Unfortunately, the growth of the non-bank sector, as well as all the complexities of financial instruments, outstripped those old regulatory regimes.
Well, now that he's rendered the old regimes obsolete, along with the traditional financial system, and mortgaged the economy to China, the Obama administration is unveiling its plan for regulating this new system. The challenge of regulating when Beijing is watching your every move. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, June 17th. Stay tuned for our conversation all about the new regulatory scheme with Peter Morici later on in the hour. I'm John Hockenberry, and with me to help out with hosting is Femi Okeh once again. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning, everybody. Coming up this hour, we get the latest on the situation in Iran, focusing on how Iranians are communicating with each other and the rest of the world. Also, did you know that some sounds are becoming endangered? We're working on a project with our partner, the BBC, to collect sounds that are going out of favor, out of fashion even. Those stories coming up, but first, headlines.
And in the headlines, Iranian opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi is calling for a day of mourning for those who've been killed in protests over last week's contested presidential election. At least seven people have been killed in clashes. That's in conjunction with mass protest rallies tomorrow. Meanwhile, our partner, the BBC, is reporting that several prominent opposition figures, including at least two journalists, have been arrested in overnight protests. Student dormitories in several cities were also reportedly attacked by members of the volunteer militia. Few details are known because of heavy restrictions on foreign news organizations. I mean,
Russia and China are expressing serious concern about tensions on the Korean Peninsula. They're urging North Korea to reopen the six-nation talks on its nuclear program. Here in the United States, President Obama is set to expand government authority over the U.S. financial markets today. He says rules are key to a successful system.
That's what makes American capitalism thrive. That's why people invest in this country. Because they have confidence that if they read a prospectus, somebody's made sure that what's in there is true.
The new measures include some more supervisory powers for the Federal Reserve and the establishment of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency to oversee financial products like mortgages. Later today, the president is expected to sign a memo to extend benefits to the lesbian and gay partners of federal employees. And that news comes according to senior administration officials. And those benefits are not expected to include full health insurance coverage, which would require congressional action.
Big economic indicator due out this hour, retail inflation for last month expected to be up a bit. Yesterday, we learned that wholesale inflation rose only 0.2% in May. On Wall Street yesterday, Dow and S&P both fell over 1%. The S&P starts trading at 912. We're calling it the Museum of Future Shock. Things change so rapidly, so we're collecting endangered sounds on our website in collaboration with the BBC.
Hi, this is Carol from Exeter, New Hampshire, and the sound that I remember that I haven't heard in years is an airplane breaking the sound barrier.
Sonic booms. What else would you put in the museum of the stuff we left behind? Sounds or experiences, anything. Be a curator, won't you? And call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Use a rotary phone.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. We begin in Tehran, as we have all week long. It's yet another day of protest demonstrations in Iran. Mousavi, the opposition candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi, today called for a day of mourning for those who have been killed, and more rallies are planned for later today. We spoke earlier with the BBC's correspondent in Tehran, Marcus George, one of many from our colleagues at the BBC. When I spoke with Marcus, I asked him to tell us his restrictions on covering all of these demonstrations and what he's been able to learn.
Yesterday, we received official notification that the activities of the foreign media here in Tehran would not and should not cover any illegal activity, any illegal protest. That was sent to us by the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, and they were very stringent on that. So effectively, it means that we cannot go out in the streets with recording equipment, with cameras, and actually cover any demonstrations or any events which they do not give us specific permission to do. So fairly stringent restrictions, and it obviously means that we can only really tell you about what's going on from eyewitness reports and so on, which we hear from.
Well, before we get to those eyewitness reports, what is the sense of people in Tehran? Do they feel as though things are orderly or that they are spiraling out of control in some sense?
I think they're very, very aware that at the moment it's a very tense situation, and yet for the time being it's maintaining its peacefulness. There have been millions of people on the streets over the past 2 or 3 days, both for pro-Ahmadinejad rallies and protests and pro-opposition protests led by the leading opposition candidate Mir Hussein Mousavi. So there's been a lot of people here. The lid has been kept on those tensions so far. I think behind the scenes, amongst the political elite, there have been a lot of negotiations to try and calm down, to try and ensure that this doesn't boil over. But at the same time, there are all the ingredients for it to do just that. And so I think at the moment, state TV, they're effectively having lots of guests on, including members of parliament here, saying, well, we need to be aware of our language. We need to realize and we need to understand that the Iranian people are unified and that they're not against this system and that they just should be allowed to continue their protests. And that's on state TV.
Marcus, how much of this is a heated argument over the conduct of the election itself and the procedures for recounting? And how much of this is more of a cultural conflict deeper within Iran between a traditional pro-Ahmadinejad Islamic Iran and a cynical protesting intellectual elite that may be younger than the traditional crowd?
Well, I think that's exactly it. Those are the divisions which you have here. On the one hand, you've had people who really they understand the system under which they live, and they weren't rallying against the system. But what they wanted was a free and fair vote. The longer that goes on, the longer this problem goes on, I think the actual system comes into question. The actual authority of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who's getting more and more involved day by day in the actual politics of it all. And I think that people are really beginning to question that authority now, certainly in the urban capital, Tehran. So it is getting quite difficult. And I think the longer it goes on, the more strained the whole Islamic Republic will be because of these problems.
Marcus George, what is the state of the recount that was announced yesterday, and how will that information be disseminated to the people? And then I have one more question before we go.
We heard yesterday that the Guardian Council was giving this election result its full consideration as regards the complaints in certain areas of Tehran and around the country about what's perceived or what's claimed to be fraudulent and rigged results. So it says it's going to go ahead with that under the guidance of the supreme leader. We don't know exactly when they're going to report back. To begin with, we heard it was going to take about 10 days. It may well take sooner now, because frankly, the longer this goes on, as I said, the more stressful it becomes. So we will find out at some point. However, it's not enough for the opposition. They're still calling for a full rerun of the election,
sure,
claiming that the whole thing has been a sham.
Finally, Marcus, the government has sort of a fine line to march here. In some sense, it's in the government's interest to show the world that there are protests and that they are permitted in Iran, yet it's also not in their interest for things to be perceived as spiraling out of control. How do they balance this?
Well, it has been a balance. Yesterday morning, we were even able to make, for the first time in 2 or 3 days, international phone calls. We seem to be unfettered. Access to BBC channels here in Iran were completely unaffected. Iranians could watch those without any problem at all. And then all of a sudden, an hour or two later, they were cut off. The international telecommunications system was cut off. And, of course, as you know, we received this official notification that we wouldn't be able to report from the streets of Tehran any longer. So it seems that it's going hour by hour. They are trying to try every which way in which to ease things up and then all of a sudden clamp things down again.
Right.
And it really is very short-term decisions which have been taken here by the authorities.
And hour by hour, the social media around the world reverberate with their own headlines. Our thanks to Marcus George, who joined us from Tehran. Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you.
So we want to get a sense of how people outside of Iran are getting information about what's going on in the country. One of those ways is BBC Persian TV.
موسیقی و بیشتر از موسیقی. تلویزیون فارسی BBC.
Joining us now is Kazra Naji. He's a specialist correspondent for BBC Persian Television in London. He's also the author of the book Ahmadinejad, The Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. Kazra, thank you so much for being part of The Takeaway this morning. Have to ask you first off, you are a very famous Iranian journalist. What are you doing in London?
Well, I would have loved to be in Tehran at the moment, but the authorities in Iran are not allowing us to report from Iran. Nobody from the BBC Persian Television is given accreditation to work from Tehran. So in the end, I have ended up here, staying here, monitoring the events from London.
Now, as a Persian speaker, as a Persian broadcasting service, you have incredible access. But what are the challenges of getting this story together and then broadcasting it back into Iran?
Well, when we started at first, given the fact that the authorities were not going to give us accreditation to have a correspondent in Tehran, we thought it's going to be difficult because our access to information is going to be limited. But in actual fact, in practice, it has been a lot better than we expected. We're getting a lot of telephone calls. We're getting a lot of information. BBC has correspondent in Tehran. There are agencies in normal times, Reuters, AP, AFP, they're all there. We're getting information and pictures from all these places, plus the fact that we have a very popular interactive program during which it's an hour a long program during the day when people ring in from throughout the country to talk about a certain subject that is the topic of the day. And this has been an incredible success in the sense that we're getting opinion and information from these people from throughout the country about these. One thing that stuck in my mind was when the fiasco in Gaza was underway, and we were getting telephone calls from various towns and cities throughout the country for and against Israelis, for and against Hamas and the Palestinians, and a major and very lively debate.
Let me bring you back to this particular story. Getting information from your audience. Tell me a one story that's actually stood out in your mind.
Well, in the last few days, we've had callers from Iran telling us about what's happening in their localities. Like, we had calls from Shiraz saying that, you know, there's a demonstration outside my door and this is what's happening kind of thing. And we've been getting quite a few of those. And, of course, you have the YouTube, you have the Twitter, you have the Facebook, you have all that. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. A communication in Iran these days, during the days of troubles in Iran, is limited. Like yesterday, we had this huge demonstration in Tehran, and we didn't have that much information from the actual scene of the demonstration because, A, mobile phone networks had been cut off, their electricity had been cut off. So, and this is a huge demonstration, so it takes you a long time to walk towards a place where you can get in a car and go to some place where you can actually make a phone call. SMS, short message system, has been cut off, and dial-up system of the internet is very difficult to get through, and when you do get through, is the speed is so slow that it's a torture to upload anything, but nevertheless people do.
That was the BBC's Khazra Naji. He is a special correspondent for the BBC Persian Television Service in London. He's also a very well-known Iranian journalist. Thank you so much, Khazra Naji, for being part of our programme this morning.
He's famous in Iran. I mean, Persian Television it's like Radio Free Europe. They're beaming into Tehran.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. So public radio listeners, I think it's fair to say, are all sort of curators of sound.
Okay.
Don't you think?
Yes.
I mean, if you actually listen to NPR, they have this whole series called Lost and Found Sound, where people go back into their drawers and find tapes of relatives and things and tell stories. In our future shock world, we thought we would pause for a moment and sort of think about maybe some futuristic sounds that were advanced sounding very recently but are almost obsolete, like this one. Can't even hear this anymore. The sound is actually still there.
What is that?
But that's the analog signal of white noise on a television. But if you have a digital TV, you can't hear it.
Right.
Because there are no analog TVs anymore, right? Some of you may have one. We want you, though, to be curators of sounds that are disappearing in our futuristic world that is advancing so rapidly. Like, for instance, there's this sound here, which you may remember. Right? The dial-up modem. Rapidly becoming extinct. Send us your suggestions. They don't have to be sounds. Say, going to the drive-in movies, experiences that are rapidly, like, moving into the past and are becoming obsolete. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Joining us now is Kate Arklis-Gray, who's in charge of the BBC's Save Our Sounds program. She's here in the studio. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
So I want you to sort of go on this journey with us as well. You're familiar with the two sounds that I just played there, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And this one you may even know, right?
You've got mail.
And that's the sound of the voice of AOL, which some people actually still use, but I think it's safe to say that that has receded into the dim past of the recent future.
Yeah, that reminds me of my first ever experience with email.
I see, and maybe we don't want to share that, actually. But what is your project at the BBC, and how are you approaching this idea of endangered sounds? Because there's a certain amount of urgency to what you're doing.
We're running a project called Save Our Sounds, and basically we're asking people all around the world to send in recordings of where they live. We're really interested in hearing the kind of soundscapes, cityscapes, and we're particularly interested in endangered sounds. We're not just talking about bird song or endangered animals, but things like you played the 56K modem, things like the dot matrix printer. Do you remember that noise?
Oh, yeah, that's right. We don't have it.
That's the one.
Actually, I can't even do it anymore because I've forgotten it. But there's this sound. You recognize this? Oh, come on. You're not drawing a blank. You know what that is, right?
That's one of the old dial telephones.
Let's stump Kate here on this one. You know this sound?
Oh, it's a typewriter.
Yeah, they're easy. Those are easy ones, right? Now, you have been doing sounds that are much broader and maybe a little more anthropological, almost cultural, in their mission. Describe the kinds of things that people are sending in to you.
Well, we've had all sorts of things. We've had, like, some Mexican fireworks somebody sent in. There's somebody in Australia who gets woken up by a train every night that goes through, and it has the kind of the dinging noise as it goes through a kind of a railroad blocking the road.
Why do people think those kinds of sounds are endangered?
I don't know if those are so much endangered, but they're like part of the soundscape that we take for granted.
Well, let's hear some of the examples. So you can go to the Save Our Sound website, right, on the BBC space, and hear those sounds sent in by listeners from Turkey, Scotland, Belgium, and Morocco. It's not so much that they're endangered, maybe, it's that they're just, like, they're in love with these sounds, right, and they want to share them.
Yeah, I mean, what we're trying to do is take an audio snapshot of the world. I mean, if you think about it, with things like Flickr, there's an amazing number of photographs of the world. There are so many books about the history of the world. And audio is something that we just seem to take for granted. And yet it's such a kind of powerful thing. You know, if you hear some of those sounds, you know, if you've ever been to Marrakesh, for example, and you hear that sound, it takes you straight back there. You know, I hear that and it reminds me of holidays and things like that. And we're trying to, you know, just make people stop and listen to the sounds around them, not take them for granted, and then hopefully send them in. And what we have on our website is this really exciting interactive map. So you upload sounds to it, and you can place them exactly where they were recorded, and then you can sort of take a journey around the world listening to other people's sounds.
And do you think that the world is converging to a kind of conformity, a uniformity in sound, that it will sound the same in one place as it does in another, and that the distinctiveness of some of these sounds may be slowly disappearing?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, a lot of places now are sort of becoming built up, and you're seeing, like, the rise of big cities, and, yeah, I mean, that means that we are losing a whole set of soundscapes, and you know, as people move from, like, tuk-tuks and bicycles to cars.
Tuk-tuks? Describe.
They're like,
little motorized scooter type things,
yeah.
Find them in Thailand.
Exactly.
Yep.
And, the sort of toot-toot
that
you get.
And they actually say, tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk. Yeah. That's actually the sound they make.
Exactly. But if everybody moves over to cars, then you're going to hear just the same kind of engine sounds everywhere. So we're trying to get people to send in those sounds of where they live so that we can have a record of that for the future.
Kate, some parts of the world, like Africa, like Asia, listen to radio probably more than anywhere else. So while I'm struggling to think of a sound image, there are lots of places where you're going to get incredible sounds. Are you already beginning to see that trickle in from Africa or from Asia, where the sounds are very different from perhaps the Western part of the world?
I mean, we've only very recently launched the project, but I mean, that's exactly what we're hoping to get. And we're opening this out to as many people as we can. People can upload straight to our website. If they have an iPhone, they can use an application called Audio Boo, which is a free application. You can record a sound. If you tag it with BBC_SOS, it gets drawn into our map, and the sort of geotagging will place it on the map. Or, you know, if you're in some of those places where maybe you don't have an iPhone, you don't have an internet connection like that, you can ring in your sounds, or you can just send us a cassette.
And all this is available on our website as well, at takeaway.org, which is linked to all this. You can hear all the sounds that you heard in this segment, experience our own endangered sounds, and send sounds to us in the same way. Kate Arglis-Gray, project catalyst for the BBC's Save Our Sounds program, in the studio on her way back to London. Safe travels, Kate. And now, Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes past the hour. Iranian opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi is calling for a day of mourning and protests tomorrow for those who've been killed over last week's contested presidential election in demonstrations. At least 7 people have been killed in clashes between protesters and security forces. Any rallies would defy an official ban on protests. In the U.S., companies that own nearly half the nation's nuclear reactors aren't setting aside enough money to dismantle the plants and remove radioactive material when they close. That's all required by law, according to a new analysis by the AP. Reactors can sit idle for decades, posing a safety and security risk. Another hydrogen problem is grounding the Space Shuttle Endeavour today. The shuttle's originally launch date last week was postponed because of a similar leak. Here is NASA's Deputy Program Manager, Leroy Kane.
From here, where do we go forward? We've got to step back and try to understand this problem, and we will do that. I'm confident we will do that.
Kane says NASA can't try again for Endeavour until July, which means new construction on the space station is postponed. Femi and John.
Thank you, Mark.
Cheers, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Remember to add your endangered sound to our website museum. The BBC is preserving endangered sounds. What would you put in our sound museum?
Hello, my name is Gordon Astley, calling from the United Kingdom, listening to you online. The sound I miss most is this. Yes, it's the sound of silence.
That's great. Give us some examples of things that are gone from your ears at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Dead air is perfectly permissible here on The Takeaway. My Takeaway, my take at thetakeaway.org is our website.
Let me take you now to the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, to a country known as Yemen. We're asking this morning if the question is Yemen becoming the new front for al-Qaeda. Now, this week, three foreigners were killed and six others remain missing in kidnappings in Yemen. Some experts believe that al-Qaeda is responsible and is able to flourish in the Arab world's poorest country. Joining us to talk about al-Qaeda in Yemen is Gregory Johnson from Princeton University. Morning, Gregory.
Good morning.
Now tell us, what is the latest that you know about the kidnappings?
Well, there's a lot that isn't known right now. So basically, we know what it is that you've said, that three people have been confirmed dead and six are missing. There has yet to be a statement of responsibility from al-Qaeda, which now looks more and more like this is something that organization in Yemen might have been behind. Initially, there were a number of conflicting claims, and as we continue to not see a statement of responsibility, there are more and more scenarios and theories and rumors that are making themselves known.
Just also getting some information over the news wires that two of the dead hostages were German nationals, and some of their investigators are actually arriving in Yemen today to investigate what happened to them. But meanwhile, a lot of fingers are being pointed at al-Qaeda as being responsible. What clues are you seeing, if any?
Well, certainly kidnappings of foreigners, whether they be tourists or foreign workers in Yemen, is something that's been part of the political landscape there for quite a while. What traditionally happens is that tribesmen will take these hostages, these tourists or foreigners, as a way of forcing the government's hand on any number of different issues. But usually these tourists and these hostages are released unharmed. So this has certainly been a break with tradition, which is why I think many people are suspecting that al-Qaeda is behind it. Just recently, in the most recent issue of al-Qaeda's bimonthly journal that they put out from Yemen, the emir of the organization there threatened all non-Muslims with death if they didn't leave the country of Yemen.
So where does al-Qaeda's bimonthly journal go to? Who's receiving this?
Well, it's posted to different jihadi forums on the internet. So it's kind of uploaded by the organization through a middleman, and then it's downloaded by people around the world. I get it on my computer here in Princeton. People in the Middle East, people in Yemen can download it, print it off, and then pass it around hand to hand.
So, you know, there's an ethnic issue here, and I wonder if you'd explain it. Al-Qaeda's original mission was actually to take down the royal family in Saudi Arabia, and ethnic Yemenis in southern Saudi Arabia have often been a source of confrontation for the government in Riyadh. How much of that is driving the settlement or suspicion that al-Qaeda might find a home in Yemen?
Well, al-Qaeda certainly has found a home in Yemen, and I think for the U.S., for the Yemeni government, for the Saudis, one of the most worrying aspects of this whole thing is that in many ways, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is what the group in Yemen now calls itself, is the most representative organization in Yemen as well as in Saudi Arabia. It has people from all classes, all social walks, all different tribes and all different regions of the country, which other political parties and social movements really don't have.
Gregory, what's happening with the politics and the economy in Yemen that may make it a really prime spot for al-Qaeda to base itself?
Well, what's happening is the Yemeni government at the moment really finds itself confronted by a number of different security challenges. The most important one, at least in the government's calculus, is threats of secession from the south, the government's involved in a separate civil war up in the north, as well as the al-Qaeda threat. And then combine all three of those security threats with Yemen's crumbling economy, which has really taken a hit this year, and the government has less and less resources to direct towards these. So al-Qaeda in Yemen has realized that the more chaotic it is and the more the Yemeni government is focusing its finite resources elsewhere, the less kind of pressure it can bring to bear on al-Qaeda and the more room in Yemen that al-Qaeda has in which to operate.
You mentioned rumours when we were talking about, started talking at the beginning of this conversation about Al-Qaeda perhaps being responsible, but also seeing in the news this week that there seems to be some connection between Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, maybe moving to Somalia and then on into Yemen. What's your opinion of that theory?
Well, this theory was, I think, first brought out in a New York Times report last week. And my impression is that this is something that a lot of people seem to be jumping to conclusions here. There's evidence, I think, that security analysts and intelligence agents are kind of watching individuals within Pakistan, and they're seeing some of these people move, and they're certainly seeing more communication between groups in Yemen and those in Pakistan. But I think just because those individuals are moving doesn't necessarily mean that they're showing up in Yemen. Al-Qaeda has not been very shy about announcing when it gets new members, or it's very easy to tell from reading their magazine and their publications when new members come. And at least on the Yemeni side, we just haven't seen any evidence of those people showing up in Yemen.
And finally, Gregory, just rather swiftly, how closely is the Obama administration watching these kidnappings and the story of this kidnapping in Yemen?
Well, I think very closely. The Obama administration has made closing Guantanamo and dealing with Al-Qaeda a very high priority for the administration, and things like this certainly give it cause for concern, particularly in the wake of I think, growing worries in Washington and in other capitals around the world that Al-Qaeda is going to use the undergoverned regions of Yemen for attacks throughout the Arabian Peninsula, Saudi Arabia, and into the Horn of Africa.
Gregory Johnson, thank you for sharing your expertise with us about Yemen and Al-Qaeda. Gregory Johnson is from Princeton University. Mark Garrison is from our newsroom, and he's ready with your news headlines. Mark.
Thank you, Femi. 21 minutes before the hour, and no big surprises from a report on retail inflation just out a few minutes ago. The price of stuff folks buy went up 0.1% last month. That's about in line with predictions. Gas prices have been up, though food prices are lower. Later today, President Obama is expected to propose an overhaul of financial regulation. The plan would give the Fed greater authority over large financial institutions. It would also expand the FDIC's reach in breaking up troubled financial companies. He's also expected to call for a new regulator to fill certain oversight gaps. Over on Capitol Hill, a more than $100 billion war spending bill could pass the Senate today. It narrowly passed in the House yesterday. Many Republicans object to a provision that gives $5 billion in loans to the International Monetary Fund. Here's House Republican Leader John Boehner.
The United States is going to go to China. We're going to borrow $108 billion. We're going to give it to the IMF, and they're going to give it to countries, most of whom don't like us very much.
Many anti-war Democrats also opposed the bill, but House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer urged support for troops' sake.
80% plus of this bill is about American servicemen and women in harm's way. Stand up for them.
The bill funds the war efforts through the end of the fiscal year in September. Femi and John.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Femi Okay.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Remember what you had for dinner last night?
Vaguely.
Yeah?
Well, I remember. Yes.
Oh, sorry. So look at the plate.
Okay.
Think of the plate. Let's imagine all the food you had for dinner starred in a movie, okay? Okay, so you've got the steak, lean, dark, and juicy. Obviously,
right.
The romantic hero. Okay.
Yes.
Chicken, stuffed and dressed outlandishly. Comic relief. Okay. There'd be the helpful green salad,
got
fresh
that.
And helpful.
Yes.
Tall glass of cold milk. Call her the ingenue. Yes.
Beautiful.
The tofu, the shape-shifting villain willing to take on multiple forms.
Uh-oh.
But there would be nothing in the credits for that humblest of dairy food, buttermilk. Except there is a real film about buttermilk.
You're kidding me.
Buttermilk is the star of this movie. As part of the Food Film Festival here in New York City, Buttermilk was the star.
I try to drink it every day, a little bit, yeah. My dad's convinced me that it's going to make me prettier, so I'm trying. Also bathe in it, too.
Colleen Cruz bathes in buttermilk, bathes, in fact, in daddy's buttermilk. Joining us now is Earl Cruz, farmer at the Cruz Family Dairy Farm in Knoxville, Tennessee, the subject of the documentary on buttermilk that was showcased at the New York City Food Film Festival. Good morning, Earl.
Good morning.
I'm looking at a bottle of your star buttermilk right here in front of me, and I'm about to taste it. First of all, why are you so in love with buttermilk? And if I were to cast buttermilk in a movie, would buttermilk be the hero?
Well, I think so. The reason I'm in love with buttermilk, it's in love with me. It does so much for me and everyone that consumes it. Of course, you know, there's a big difference in buttermilk. But, you know, the real value, I think, of buttermilk is the probiotics, and which can be consumed in plain yogurt in different ways. But,
Now let's talk about that for a minute. The probiotics means there are living organisms in this buttermilk, and I'm opening the bottle, not yet,
right.
Smells like buttermilk. Now, for cooking purposes, the reason buttermilk is used in things like pancakes is because it has a high acid content, right?
Right, yeah, I guess they call it lactate acid, but that's what the acid is, actually what thickens the milk.
Right, and when you make buttermilk, how do you do it? You make butter, and then the buttermilk is the waste? That's
well,
kind of a myth,
of all,
right?
First of all, you know, down here we pasteurize it, and then we add the culture back. And then we churn the milk in order to have the butter to produce the flavor. You know, the churned buttermilk is much more pleasant to consume.
All right, well, let's listen to one of the people that we got tasting your buttermilk when you were here in New York just a few days ago.
I genuinely like it. I didn't think I was going to like it, but I like it. To me, it tastes like a drinkable yogurt, like a sweet vanilla kind of yogurt.
So why does buttermilk get such a bad rap and never makes it to the food credits?
Well, you know, a lot of people aren't familiar with buttermilk, and they probably had experience with buttermilk that wasn't quite as tasty as mine, I would presume.
Well, let's have the movie theme, Gone with Wind, okay? I'm about to taste the buttermilk, Earl.
Okay, very
good. Are you a little nervous here?
Well, not really. No? I think you'll enjoy it.
You think I'm going to enjoy it?
Sure.
Nice and cold. Does taste like yogurt. Earl, that is great stuff.
Thank you very much.
Any recommendations of what I should use it for?
Well, yeah, I think you maybe start consuming about a glass a day of it and see if it changes your life in any way.
Well, as I always say, Earl, tomorrow is another day. Earl Cruz, farmer at the Cruz Family Dairy Farm in Knoxville, Tennessee, star of the Buttermilk documentary, which premiered at the New York City Food Film Festival. Thanks, Earl.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Femi Oke and John Hockenbury with you this morning, and we want you to be part of a project with the BBC. They are preserving endangered sounds that are going out of fashion, things like the Emmanuel typewriter. What would you put in the museum of sounds that we left behind?
A sound that, making an analogy to someone recently who was in their 20s, I was trying to describe a sound. It sounded sort of like the 16-millimeter projectors that you see in classrooms all the time.
That's a good one.
Sound of the film going through the mechanism, and she looked at me with this really puzzled look, and I realized she'd never been in a classroom with it. You know, I don't know what projection mechanisms they have now. That's a sound that's definitely disappeared.
Oh, I love that. It's a good one. 877-8 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. Take us down the memory audio lane, getting us bang up to date though with the latest from Iran. We have Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. 12 minutes before the hour, Iranian opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi is calling for a day of mourning and protest tomorrow. The rallies are dedicated to those killed while protesting the official presidential election results. At least 7 people have died in clashes between demonstrators and security forces. Meanwhile, several players on the Iranian national soccer team are sporting green armbands. That's the color of Mousavi's supporters. They wave it and wear it in demonstrations. Iran's team is currently playing a World Cup qualifying match in South Korea. That match, and by extension, a glimpse of the player protest has appeared on Iranian state television. Russia and China are expressing serious concerns about tensions on the North Korean peninsula. They're urging North Korea to return to six-nation talks on its nuclear program. Those broke apart months ago. And the World Health Organization is sending a team to investigate a suspected bubonic plague outbreak in Libya near the Egyptian border. John and Femi.
Thank you, Mark. All right, so President Obama, it's the other really big story this morning outside of Iran. President Obama is going to rewrite the financial rules today. It's expected to be the unveiling of the biggest overhaul of the U.S. financial system since the Great Depression, at the very least. Treasury Secretary Geithner explained some of what's likely to be seen later today.
We want a system that does a better job of preventing future crises, is more stable, more resilient, preserves the benefits of innovation, protects consumers and investors better, better tools for managing future crises.
Details of this overhaul have been trickling out for months. We aren't looking for any huge surprises. Certainly the Federal Reserve is going to have a very big role, but all eyes today are going to be on what new powers President Obama intends to give the Federal Reserve Bank. We're joined now by our good friend Peter Morici, economist and professor at the University of Maryland School of Business. Peter, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Let's talk about this regulatory regime that's going to be announced today. Barack Obama last night on CNBC said the old regulatory regimes were made obsolete by the march of hedge funds and unique financial instruments that defied regulation. First of all, is the Federal Reserve itself a regulatory body that can actually be brought to bear here?
Actually, the Federal Reserve right now is a regulatory body. It has primary responsibility for the bank holding companies, which are the large institutions that caused this problem. The basic breakdown here was the Fed did not use the powers that it had. So President Obama is putting another layer on. He's creating a committee chaired by the Secretary of the Treasury with members from the various bank regulatory agencies that we already have to advise the Fed as to when there might be a systemic risk. Look, the basic problem here was the banks put off books and offshore these risky securities and what we call SIVs. I can show you textbooks at the University of Maryland that teach you how to create a SIV. We teach alchemy at the University of Maryland as they do at Wharton and NYU. We all knew about the SIVs. Paulson knew about them. He said they don't pose a problem until they did.
All right, Hank Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary. Let's deconstruct SIVs here. What does that acronym stand for?
Structured Investment Vehicle. It's basically a place where you can park these mortgage-backed securities off the books of the banks.
All right, how
it was
can
an accounting.
If the whole idea is they're off the books, these securitized investment vehicles, how do you regulate them? Because the whole idea is to create something that's out of the shadow of regulation.
Well, the point is you got to prohibit banks from creating such entities. That's all this really comes down to. But the thing is, once we do that, they'll come up with something else. Creating a committee of bureaucrats is not going to solve the problem. What's more, it has already been widely acknowledged that our banking system is fragmentedly regulated. There are too many regulatory bodies. So what they're going to do is get rid of one and create two more on top of all the others they already have.
All right, but let's get a sense of scale here before you march ahead here.
Sure.
I mean, it seems to me on the one hand, the SEC is supposed to be regulating things like stocks and bonds. But compared to the Fed, the SEC is kind of a little card table. The Fed itself is more like the aquarium in which all of these banks float. And let's not forget, the federal government owns AIG, appears to de facto own Citigroup and Bank of America. How do you regulate something if you also own it?
Well, that's a big problem. But remember, they only own three institutions right now. So I don't think I'm too worried about that issue. I'm more concerned about what do you do with Jamie Dimon where's Jamie? I'm sorry.
J.P. Morgan Chase.
J.P. Morgan. Exactly.
You never get this stuff wrong, Peter. I'm starting to worry about it.
Yeah, I know. But in any case, how do you regulate J.P. Morgan or the others who are paying back their TARP money, but you have huge lines of credit from the Fed for which there has been no accountability?
Hmm.
By the way, this provisions does require Ben Bernanke to go get a permission slip from the Secretary of the Treasury when he makes those kinds of loans in the future. So I can just see this. Ben sees a crisis. He has to hop in a cab, trot over to Treasury, and get a little pass, like when you went to the bathroom as a kid, to then make the loans. It's really kind of silly.
Let me just back you up for 1 second.
Sure.
How much of this is about projecting the U.S. financial system as being a great place to put your money, and that it's really not intended for you and me, that this regulatory regime is all about attracting Chinese investors and making sure that they don't demand a higher interest rate when they basically buy into the U.S. economy?
I don't think we should worry as much about Chinese investors as you seem to. It's more about attracting private capital around the world to the notion that the U.S. financial system is safe and secure, and that the global financial system is safe and secure. If the New York and London markets don't work well, the global financial system breaks down. So by default, because we're the reserve currency country, we are really creating a regulatory regime which will have to be patterned the rest of the world for it to be effective. And what I'm saying to you is they're not creating that. They're not fixing what's broken. They're ladling on more whipped cream on a stale cake.
So the people who were hurt by Madoff, there's likely to be more Ponzi schemes in the future. The people who lost all their money by declining assets like Lehman Brothers going out of existence, Bear Stearns going out of existence, they have no reason to feel more protected after today?
Well, what we're having happen right now is a tightening of loopholes and regulations that's already in train. A lot of what needs to be done is already in train, but this is kind of like tightening up the tax code. The people that want to cheat on it or the people that want to evade it, which are one's illegal, one's legal, will find new ways to do it. This does not solve this problem. There are lots of regulatory bodies already, and this is going to add to them. You know, take the consumer protection agency they want to create. You've got three kinds of loans.
The Consumer mortgages, Financial Protection Agency. Right.
You've got mortgages, you got auto loans, credit cards. We just had a new credit card bill re-regulate that entity. The Federal Reserve has been reforming mortgage writing. Last I heard, there isn't a real problem with auto loans. We don't need a whole new agency to do what we just did. What we're basically going to do is create yet another board that presidents can appoint their friends to, more bureaucrats running around Washington. This is blind faith in regulation and bureaucracy, much the way the Republicans have a blind faith in markets.
Certainly, we're going to be sorting out the politics from the real economics here. One last question before we go. This organization, Ben Bernanke, will be able to break up the so-called too-big-to-fail entities, corporations, and banks. Do you think that's a good idea?
It's a good idea, but I don't know how it would be done. Look at the problems they're having with Citigroup right now. They basically want to dismember Citigroup, and they can't do it because if they're too big to fail, they're often too big to sell, even in their pieces. It's very much like what we're going through with General Motors. Again, creating an agency doesn't necessarily solve, or creating a power doesn't necessarily solve an intractable problem.
Well, but talking to Peter Morici does help me to understand an intractable regulatory scheme that's going to be announced later today. How's that for a segue, Peter?
Take care.
Peter Morici, economist and professor at the School of Business at the University of Maryland, our friend here at The Takeaway, talking about the regulatory regime that the Obama administration will announce later today.
So we are doing a little project here on The Takeaway with our partners at the BBC. We're looking to preserve endangered sounds, and we want yours. So go to our website at thetakeaway.org, and you will find, there you go, some typing. You'll find instructions on how to send a sound that you'd like to see preserved. The BBC will upload your sound to their world sound map, and then we will play a selection of your sound on The Takeaway. So, here's your takeaway.
What we're trying to do is take an audio snapshot of the world. If you think about it, with things like Flickr, there's an amazing number of photographs of the world. There are so many books about the history of the world. And audio is something that we just seem to take for granted. And yet it's such a kind of powerful thing.
That's Kate Arkless-Gray. She's the project catalyst for the BBC Save Our Sounds, Save Our Sanity here on The Takeaway. Also, take a look at thetakeaway.org for the buttermilk video.
I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Femi Okay. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, if something has a museum, it's usually a bad sign.
Located along U.S. Highway 264 in Nash County's quiet town of Bailey, the Country Doctor Museum is less than an hour's drive from Greenville in the east and Raleigh in the west. We welcome your visit to the Country Doctor Museum.
The Country Doctor Museum may showcase the olden days in rural healthcare, but economists suggest the olden days may be coming back. Primary care physicians, they save money and patients. Country doctors, acute care reform, more than a Band-Aid. We got all your boo-boos covered on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, June 17th, our healthcare discussion continues. We're going to talk with a country doctor in Grand Junction, Colorado, with some great ideas. I'm John Huckenberry. My co-host this morning is Femi Okay.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. Also coming up this hour, we will get the latest on the situation in Tehran. Another day of protests is scheduled. In fact, some of them already happening. We'll also be talking about how the recession is changing our relationships with big corporations. Those stories coming up. But first, headlines.
And in the headlines, Iranian opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi is calling for a day of both mourning and protest tomorrow. The rallies are dedicated to those killed while protesting the official presidential election results. At least seven people have been killed in clashes between demonstrators and security forces. Meanwhile, several players on the Iranian national soccer team are wearing green armbands. That's the color of Mousavi's supporters. Iran's team is currently playing a World Cup qualifying match in South Korea. That match, and consequently the protest, is appearing on Iranian state television. Femi?
That is a remarkable story. Meanwhile, back here in the United States, President Obama is said to expand government authority over the U.S. financial markets today. He's expected to create a new group that would oversee financial products like mortgages. White House economic advisor Christina Romer described it on CBS News this morning.
The new Consumer Financial Protection Agency is really going to take all of those consumer regulations and put them into one place so that there's one agency whose only job it is to watch out for consumers.
Other measures include increased regulatory powers for both the Federal Reserve and the FDIC. Russia and China are expressing concern about tensions on the Korean Peninsula. They're urging North Korea to reopen the Six Nation talks on its nuclear program. And that comes after meetings between President Obama and the South Korean leader Lee Myung-bak yesterday. They promised a united front against North Korean aggression.
One dead in a suspected bubonic plague outbreak in Libya. The World Health Organization is sending a team to investigate. Wall Street opens flat according to the futures trading. The Dow starts trading at 85.05. Inflation numbers out this morning. Inflation rose 0.1% last month. What would you put in a museum of sounds we've left behind?
What I miss in the way of sounds is the rattle of the old air-cooled Volkswagen engine. Even though I never loved Volkswagens as cars, the engines, you could tell that particular engine from yards and yards away immediately.
Curate our Museum of Endangered Sounds here on The Takeaway at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Man, that was my first car.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Here's a question for all of you straight out of the news. Is it a sign of robust democratic impulses in Iran or more a game of chicken between two powerful constituencies at odds over the outcome of last week's election in Iran? Going to Tehran now, where supporters of candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi call for a rally to go ahead today and also a day of mourning for tomorrow, despite the authorities imposing a ban on all the opposition gatherings. Another day of protests against an election many Iranians claim was manipulated. Joining us for more from Tehran is the New York Times and International Herald Tribune's columnist Roger Cohen. Roger, good morning. What restrictions do you and your colleagues at the Times have about reporting what's going on the streets of Tehran today?
It's getting increasingly difficult to report, John, in that the Ministry of Information has told correspondents here not to go out in the streets, warning them that they may be targets of the Basij, the militia here, generally trying to instill fear so that first-hand witnesses to what's going on become fewer and fewer. They're not renewing press passes. They're not renewing visas. Basically, they want to shut this down as much as possible so that things like the huge and deeply moving demonstration a couple of days ago with perhaps a million people are no longer witnessed firsthand.
Is there a way of characterizing how the Mousavi demonstrations are being organized versus how the Ahmadinejad supporters are being organized, or are they mostly the same mechanisms?
No, they're totally different. The Ahmadinejad rallies are orchestrated by the regime and facilitated by the police, including the very menacing riot police that are out in the street. I've seen them clearing the way for the Ahmadinejad supporters, who often come on motor scooters. The streets are cleared for them. Filming is encouraged, at least by the national media here. And very often the demonstrators are bussed in, or they come from ministries, state-owned enterprises. It's very much an organized thing. On the contrary, the Mousavi demonstrations require a great deal of ingenuity in order to be organized, in that text messaging has been shut down, cell phones are only working intermittently, and one of the principal means of communication is word of mouth. Other than that, of course, Twitter is being used, but it's not easy to organize these things, and the fact that you get perhaps a million people in the street with all the obstacles I've just described is one measure of the degree of anger and indignation that 4 or 5 days after the election still prevail here.
Well, you make a great point. I want to talk about the word-of-mouth network in a moment. I mean, as we both know, in Tehran, nobody in Iran ever hesitates about telling your opinion strongly, telling you their opinion about whatever is going on. I imagine even with these restrictions, it's pretty easy among a network of friends to take the pulse of how people are viewing this. Is this a tense situation? Are people fearful, or are they feeling as though they're making progress and that their voices are being heard?
Well, John, it's more than tense. It's volatile and it's violent at times. There have been people shot. There have been people stabbed, including a cameraman who was stabbed last night. What happened in the huge demonstration I described, which was one of the more remarkable events I've witnessed in what is, alas, now a rather long journalistic career, is that when you get to numbers like that, fear begins to evaporate, because while a repressive state can mow down dozens, perhaps hundreds of people, it cannot mow down hundreds of thousands of people, and that's what happened a couple of days ago. But this has been a very, very harsh clampdown, and the fact that this clampdown followed what was supposedly a victory by a very wide margin, indeed with two-thirds of the vote by President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, just makes that reaction all the stranger. If you're going to give any credibility whatsoever to that number, why, with two-thirds of the country behind you, would you immediately respond to that, not with celebration, but with a massive crackdown? And this, of course, has made most Iranians feel even more humiliated. They were encouraged to go out and vote. They did in vast numbers. They did all around the world. There were lines for the first time outside Iranian consulates and embassies from Europe to the United States. And this looked like the freest election Iran has held since its revolution 30 years ago. Then suddenly everybody was made to feel they'd been puppets in some immense game. So you can measure from that the degree of fury that this has provoked.
Roger, I want to rely now on your, and we're so grateful to have you this morning, your experience in places around the world. You're probably not monitoring the coverage here in the United States, but you're hearing a lot of very loose use of international metaphors in describing what's going on in the streets of Tehran. Is Mousavi, for instance, having a Boris Yeltsin moment, staring down the regime in Russia? Is this a Tiananmen Square kind of scenario that we're seeing unfolding in Tehran? Would you embrace any such metaphor, or would you reject them all at this point?
I think we're on the brink here. It's on a razor's edge. It's one of those moments where things could shift or this could evaporate. Of course, Iran has been here before in 99 with the student protests, in 2003 again, but never with this breadth of opposition and never with this degree of intensity. I think a crucial question going forward will be, can Amir Hussein Mousavi, the opposition reformist candidate, can he lead? Is he in a position to lead? This is a movement that requires a leader. He did appear a couple of days ago. But, of course, former President Khatami, Mohammed Khatami, who was in charge at the time of the other protests I just mentioned, he retreated at the breach. Now, what will Mousavi do? Mm. But, yes, I think those kinds of comparisons are tenable because you have a massive peaceful resistance movement to what is seen as a fraudulent election. And while the state still has the monopoly of power, of weaponry, the spiritual force, if you want to call it that, is on the other side. And where that comes out is anybody's guess. You'd have to say that the state, which has the means of repression, probably still has to be the favorite to win out.
But well, it's almost irresistible.
It's very delicately poised right now.
It's almost irresistible to compare, to draw the line from Khatami to Gorbachev and Mousavi to Yeltsin, if you say that some of these comparisons are tenable. A final question before we go.
Yeah.
What can the government do in unfolding this recount or in evaluating and telling people that they're investigating fraud to, in any sense, reassure people? Or is the genie out of the bottle at this point?
Well, I don't think that the Guardian Council, which is doing this recount, is really a credible body for such a task. It's basically stuffed with Ahmadinejad supporters. Indeed, it's a 12-member body, 6 lawyers, 6 clerics, and one of the lawyers is also Ahmadinejad's government spokesman. So I don't think people really have any belief that out of this recount will come some different outcome. The issue is a different one, and that is, can Mousavi, through the huge numbers of people on the street, somehow force an annulment of the election, which is what he is asking for? And will the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, at some point judge that Ahmadinejad, rather than being a boost to him, has in fact become a liability? Because Khamenei has it in his power to reverse this and to take the country to a new election. He will do so is an open question as we speak.
And presumably that may be the strategy for opposition leader Mousavi, who is calling for a mass rally to be held within the next couple of hours. I mean, I don't want you to disclose any details about your circumstances, Mr. Cohen, but I suspect as far as your visa is concerned, the clock is ticking for how long you can remain, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I'm legally in the country. I have a visa, and as long as I have a visa, I plan to try to do what I can do. A lot of my colleagues have left because their visas expired, and as I said, they're not being renewed. The situation is increasingly delicate in terms of the ways in which one can work, but there are always means to work, and obviously I think all my colleagues feel that this is a huge moment. This is a very critical, pivotal moment, not only for Iran, also for the world.
Well, Roger Cohen, columnist for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune, is right there in the middle of it in Tehran. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, Roger.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway,
from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Huckenberry. Be sure to be a curator and add an endangered sound to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're joined with the BBC, our partner, preserving endangered sounds. What would you put in our sound museum?
Hi, this is Dan calling from Manhattan. A sound that I would put in the sound museum, if you will, would be when an old computer would boot up and it would check the 3.5-inch hard drives or the doo-doo-doo-doo. That would be it.
That's great. Great examples we're getting from all of you. Things that are gone from your ears at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Sounds that are endangered. Leave them at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi?
Making news today, President Obama will sign a presidential memorandum later on to extend benefits to same-sex partners of federal employees. That could be the most significant statement he's made so far on gay issues. Now, to get down to the nitty-gritty of what's in the memo, we're joined by Politico's Ben Smith. Morning, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you know about what's covered in this memo?
Well, basically a lot less than meets the eye. When they announced last night that they were extending benefits to gay and lesbian spouses of federal workers, everybody immediately assumed they meant health benefits, and that's what it said on the front page of the New York Times and everywhere else, you know, for about half an hour. But it turns out that's not what they mean, because the Defense of Marriage Act bans health and retirement benefits for gay employees of the federal government. And so it's things like relocation assistance for federal employees who are moving. It's much less dramatic stuff than one might assume, although it's certainly an important symbolic gesture.
So, in terms of it being a memo and not an executive order, what's the significance of that?
You know, the White House is still a presidential. I mean, it has the same effect. It's something that Obama is putting into law. It's somewhat less permanent, essentially.
And this is
and then they've explained that for technical reasons about this kind of change, it's required to be. The White House is arguing that it says that that's just that it's a technical difference, essentially.
This is a story that you've already reported on. Could you tell, was this already on the president's schedule, or has this been put in because he's had so much pressure about doing something about gay rights?
As far as I can tell, this was moved up after an outcry starting last week over a brief the administration filed in federal court in California, in which they defended the Defense of Marriage Act in very traditional terms, kind of drew a parallel between same-sex marriage and marrying your sister, all sorts of things like that, and the gay and lesbian community went nuts about that, and Joe Biden has a fundraiser with gay and lesbian supporters coming up next week in Washington, and boycotts were starting, their protests being organized, and I think they're trying to, you know, give Biden something positive to say at that event and to damp down this really rising tide of anger.
Well, Ben Smith, what do you have as an explanation for this apparent fact error about people getting it wrong, thinking that there were health care benefits, and then we realize that it's less than meets the eye? I mean, is this a clumsiness in how the administration handled the release of this information, or were they actually trying to get out ahead of this criticism and wanting to sort of pull a fast one here?
No, I think they just rushed the rollout a bit and didn't explain it very clearly initially. I don't think they were trying to pull a fast one. In fact, it had the effect of, for a minute, their gay and lesbian friends saying, ah, good, they're finally doing something, and then just kind of doubling the anger. And the email I'm getting this morning, I've just got one from David Mixner, who's a very prominent kind of fundraiser and activist, you know, who said, are they kidding us? What kind of reality do they live in? It's like rubbing salt in the wound.
And those are comments likely to be given to Joe Biden at his fundraiser that's coming up, right?
Yeah, or shouted at him from across the street, I think, yeah.
What other kind of criticism are you picking up on, Ben?
Well, I mean, the basic criticism is that he made big promises to, you know, start openly admitting gays and lesbians into the military, to end the Defense of Marriage Act, which would then make these benefits, make it possible to extend these federal benefits. Like, those are the two really big ones. Those are big, big changes that would affect a lot of people in a real way and are heavy political lifts. And the administration just has not wanted to go near them.
Anybody happy about this memo this afternoon?
I mean, you know, it is going to, I imagine, have positive effects for real people. Like, I think I saw an estimate that there are 2 million gay and lesbian federal workers, and, you know, I think it would be a degree of federal recognition for their relationships. I think there are, you know, you have a lot of, I mean, for instance, in the State Department, Hillary Clinton has extended, has already did something like this within the State Department, and it means, for instance, that if you're relocating to Romania, you and your spouse also get language training in advance of the trip, and that's pretty meaningful, you know, or an access to State Department health clinics, things like that. Like, they're meaningful things. It's just that if you're a postal worker, you can't put your spouse on your health care plan, and that's just obviously the most important benefit.
So we're not talking about health care benefits, we're not talking about pension benefits or 401k benefits, but we are talking about other job-related benefits that can be now extended to your same-sex partner.
Right, and Obama couldn't extend those without an act of Congress, but he could try to get an act of Congress, and he has not tried.
Okay, Ben Smith, who is the one of the correspondents at Politico.com, thank you very much for joining us this morning. To get up to date with some other news stories with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. We're coming up to 28 minutes after the hour. Iranian opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi is calling for rallies tomorrow dedicated to those who've been killed protesting the official election results that show Mousavi losing. Any rallies would defy an official ban on protests. This also comes amid new reports of opposition leaders under arrest, more of them. And in a high-profile act of defiance, several members of the Iranian national soccer team sported green armbands during a World Cup qualifying match in South Korea today. Green is the color of Mousavi's campaign. That match was broadcast on Iranian state television, possibly meaning the armbands have been seen around the nation. The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog group says Iran is mastering nuclear technology and wants the option of making a nuclear weapon. The International Atomic Energy Agency head, Mohammed El-Baradei, says there should be engagement with Iran to remove incentive for creating a bomb. Over on Capitol Hill, a more than $100 billion war spending bill could pass the Senate today. It narrowly passed in the House yesterday. Many Republicans object to a provision that gives $5 billion in loans to the International Monetary Fund. The bill funds troops through the end of the fiscal year in September. Another hydrogen leak grounded the Space Shuttle Endeavour today. The shuttle's original launch date last week was postponed because of a similar leak during fueling. NASA now can't launch Endeavour again until July, which means new construction on the International Space Station is on hold. Finally, yesterday we talked about new sports trying to get to the Olympics. Today it's all about cities. The finalists to host the 2016 Summer Games make a key presentation to Olympic decision makers today. Chicago, Madrid, Tokyo, and Rio de Janeiro are all in the running. Chicago is throwing everyone with a Chicago connection to the bid, from President Obama to Michael Jordan. And the International Olympic Committee is going to make the final decision in October. John and Femi.
Thanks, Mark.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Femi Okeh with John Hockenberry this morning, and we are collecting endangered sounds with our partner, the BBC. You can add yours really easily just by going to our website, thetakeaway.org, and tell us, what would you put in a museum of sounds we're leaving behind?
Good morning. I'm just calling to remind you of a sound that we used to hear that has gone completely obsolete. That would be the clicking of the analog dial on your old television set. My dad used to yell, "Go easy on that dial."
It's brilliant. That goes back way back. Tell us the sounds from your past that you would archive in our sound museum. 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can also email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
That's a bunch of old techie geezers. Aren't exactly our demo. Oh, well. One of the things that went away a long time ago is the idea of a corporate charter. What do I mean by that? Well, if you wanted to build a road or something back in the 1700s in early America, you had to create a company to do it, and you couldn't just fill out pieces of paper or something. You had to go to the government and actually ask them, and they could say, no, forget about it. How do we get here, though, in this financial crisis? In his new book, Life, Inc., Douglas Rushkoff claims that it's taken 450 years for corporations to go from being very dubious institutions that we were scared of here in the United States and regulated to death, or to being liberated to the point where they have the same rights as citizens have, to then becoming a model for governance in the United States. Manage government like a business. Where did we go wrong? Douglas Rushkoff is here with us in the studio. Douglas, thanks for joining us.
Hey, great to be here.
This is a fascinating story. Remind us of just how dubiously the framers of the Constitution viewed corporations back in the 1700s and before.
Well, framers of the Constitution had just lived through a kind of a corporatist dictatorship, if you will. You know, the American colonists were living under the British East India Trading Company. And their revolution was really less against the throne than against corporations that had laws written for them that didn't allow colonists to trade. I mean, you could grow cotton on your fields, but then you couldn't sell it to other people. You couldn't make clothes out of it or hats or mittens. You had to sell it to the British East India Trading Company that had a chartered monopoly over cotton. They shipped it back to England, made it into fabric and garments, and then shipped it back to the colonies, and then you'd have to buy it again from them.
So corporations were a dirty word in this period. How did they evolve from being these dubious institutions that we wanted to avoid and regulate in very, very stringent ways to being actually liberated and equated, I believe, in the Supreme Court as citizens?
Well, it was a long, slow, and somewhat unsteady path. I mean, corporations basically live forever, so they can wait. You know, so they sit and wait until eventually some court gives them a little right here, a little right there. You know, originally the framers wanted corporations – well, many of them didn't want any corporations at all.
Right.
And they finally said, all right, we'll let there be chartered corporations if they serve a purpose other than making money, you know, to build some kind of a bridge or take care of some great public need, because then we'll charter a company to do that and we can understand why they need a monopoly over that area to take care of it. And then slowly but surely, business people realized that by aligning themselves with corporations, they could get kind of unfair advantages on the supposedly level playing field of free market capitalism. So that if you were a railroad tycoon, say, now you have government monopoly protection to build your railroad, and what do you do with that? You become a real estate speculator for all the land alongside the railroads.
And indeed, that's how the fortunes that were built up around the railroads were made, as a combination of creating an infrastructure and then riding the rising value of the real estate that built up around it.
Right.
Now, some would say that that narrative is also the narrative of increasing wealth and prosperity in the United States, and that there's no way to reverse it, nor would we even want to.
Well, I don't know that you can reverse it. I mean, and it is the story of really the expansion of wealth from 1300s European early nations right through the conquest of South America and America, the conquest of a lot of Africa. Mm. I mean, it was a very effective means to expand an economy and to expand empires, you know, at the expense of other peoples in other regions. But it definitely worked and grew the economy. The problem is we've ended up being born into a society that sees, that experiences this growth as now necessary. What we did was we used growth and an expanding economy to expand our nations, but now we have the imperative of growth, and that's very different.
How did money change as this idea of the corporation changed, and how is it changing again in this troubled economic environment?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the money we use is actually – it's a derivative already. You know, it's not even real money. I mean, I look at money as a media theorist. So way back when, we had local currencies that were really grain-based currencies, and it left the rich out.
So you know, if you lived in a rice town, you traded in rice. You lived in a wheat town,
you traded in wheat.
You got
receipts for that rice or receipts for that wheat, and the receipts would lose value over time. But the problem was the middle class started to do really well under that system. So King said, let's create coin of the realm. Let's lend currency into existence instead of letting people develop their own. They made all these currencies illegal, and they created debt-based currency.
Last thing, and you know, I could talk to you for the whole hour, but we got to go. When the Obama administration announces these new regulations today, and the financial channels and some of the conservative commentaries on the financial channels say these are unprecedented regulations of corporations, historically, what do Americans need to know to put that in context?
What they really need to know is that big corporations love top-down regulation of this sort. This is regulation that's occurring on a corporate scale, and it will always favor corporations. It's just like when you regulate the toy industry and say you need to do $100,000 of testing now to release a toy on the market so that there's no red paint in it or lead paint. Who does that favor? The big corporation. Who does it put out of business? Anybody who makes less than $100,000 of toys.
Douglas Rushkoff, professor at New School and author of Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. Thanks, Douglas. And headlines now from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. 21 minutes before the hour, several members of Iran's national soccer team slapped a bold protest on their uniforms today. They sported green armbands during a World Cup qualifier match in South Korea. That's the color of opposition presidential candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi. That match was broadcast on Iranian state television. Mousavi is calling for rallies tomorrow dedicated to those killed in clashes with security forces while protesting the count. China and Russia are stepping up public pressure on North Korea. Both countries' leaders are now calling on Pyongyang to get back to the negotiating table on nukes. Six-party talks broke down months ago, even before the North's most recent tests of missiles and a nuclear device. Earlier this morning, North Korea put out a statement with more threats of military retaliation against the U.S. if provoked. Here in the States, there's fresh economic news just out this morning. The Consumer Price Index, that is economists talk for the prices of stuff regular folks buy, that went up 0.1% this month. It's always like CPI, everything gets thrown around like that. They basically just call around to stores and how much is butter, how much is gas, like everything like that.
Consumer price
index. Add it all up and it went up 0.1%. So that's in line with predictions. If you want to get a little more specific, gas prices were up, food
gas,
prices were down.
Gas, that's the stuff you put in cars that makes the engines turn and
the
wheels go
causes
around,
some kind of chemical reaction. Yeah. I don't know like that. In any case, let's go to Washington at the White House today.
That's the house where the president lives.
All right, fine. In that house, President Obama is expected to propose an overhaul of financial regulation. Give more power to the Fed, a little more power to the FDIC, maybe a new regulator is what they're talking
FDIC,
about.
FDIC, and I can explain that.
Federal
Deposit Insurance Corporation. Thank you, Mark.
They help you.
I'm so obnoxious.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I am Femi OK. So, one of the world's biggest science experiments, nuclear fusion no less, is being threatened by rising costs, delays and some technical challenges. The ITER project was set up 3 years ago to build an experimental nuclear fusion reactor in the south of France. But now the economy might mean that fusion as a commercial power source is at least 100 years away.
It's a bit of a setback there.
That's
a
major setback.
Bit of a setback.
I wanted to report on the end of that experiment. So, our friend Matt McGrath, he's a BBC science correspondent. He joins us with some more information. Matt, first of all, can you give us a very simple definition of what nuclear fusion is? Obviously, I know, but it would be nice for maybe one or two people who are not up to date with that.
No problems. Well, you know, at the moment we have nuclear power, we have nuclear energy, and what we do is we split atoms. We do nuclear fission. We split atoms, we get energy from them, boil water, make steam, create electricity. Fusion, though, takes the other view. It sticks atoms together at extremely high temperatures, and it does this using basic ingredients like seawater and other materials. And if you can do that, it's really cheap, but the problem is how do you build it? And this is the big scientific challenge that nobody's been able to crack as yet.
Can you name which atoms they use in fusion, Matt?
They use two. They use deuterium and tritium. These are the two isotopes of hydrogen that they use to cause the best type of reaction. The big problem with this, though, of course, is that it's not necessarily the atoms. People can do this type of experiment. Is how do you contain it? You know, the phrase they use is, we can put the sun in a box, meaning that fusion is like the sun in the sky. It's the same type of energy source. But how do you build a box to contain it? Because the temperatures, they are 150 million degrees. I mean, that's an incredible box if you can build one to hold that type of material.
You've been to see it, Matt. What's it like?
At the moment, it's just a huge, big building site because they are the emails we've seen about the project show that the costs have doubled since 2006, and we're talking large amounts of money here, $16 billion to just construct it alone. So you can imagine it's the biggest science project in the world. In Cataraches, in the south of France, where they've picked the site for ITER, a very, very beautiful place. You can see the Alps from there. The other alternative was to go to Japan, and somehow they managed to go to the south of France. That's a very interesting decision. But at the moment, it's just a building site. They're hoping to get some reviews done on the project and to carry on with the construction. But there is a lot of concern at the moment that the project mightn't fulfill its promise.
What's the technology for containment here? Since, as you said, that's the big issue. Is it a magnetic bottle they're trying to use? The Russians had something called a tokamak. Years back. What are they using?
Absolutely, John. You're right on the money there. They're going to build a bigger tokamak, and they're going to use huge magnets to contain the plasma, as it's called, this superheated gas. The problem is the material is coating the plasma, the chamber itself. Nobody's invented those yet because the materials create these neutrons that are so radioactive, they would irradiate everything around them in fusion. So you've got to build a material that's both porous to let these neutrons through and watertight to contain everything else. And so nobody's done this yet, and that's one of the big failings that many scientists say, that, look, you're trying to build a machine, you haven't even invented the materials that are going to go into it yet. You're putting the cart before the horse.
Just wrapping up here, Matt, do you think we're going to see the end of this project?
I think that the project will go ahead, but it may be downscaled quite a bit, and it might take an awful long time to actually make fusion happen. The scientists say they're committed, but it's hugely expensive, and they haven't solved all the technical hurdles yet.
That's the BBC's Matt McGraw. He's a science correspondent. He was talking to us about the nuclear fusion experiment happening in the south of France, the ITER project. You were being a Mr. Cleverington there, weren't you, John?
A little bit. But apparently the French don't mind being irradiated. I didn't realize that in the south of France. I mean, you can get neutrons with your cheese.
You done?
Never.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's Femi OK and John Hockenbury, part of your morning today, and we want you to be part of a project with the BBC looking for endangered sound and saving old sound like the manual typewriter. What would you put in the Museum of Sounds We Left Behind?
The sound I think I miss is the sound of a record changer as one album ends and another begins.
Yes.
You have the sound of the needle scraping against the paper on the album, and then the mechanical sounds of the tone arm returning to first position, and then the scrape of the vinyl against the spindle, and finally the satisfying crackle, and finally the tune of your first song.
Absolutely brilliant.
That's my favorite one.
That is fantastic.
And do you remember the way the records used to be stacked up when they go down one by one? We've got work to do. 8778 My Take or My Take at thetakeaway.org. Send us the sounds you would like to be preserved. Now we're heading out to Mark Garrison. He's got our latest news headlines, Mark.
If we come back a little bit later, we'll get the sound of when you forget to flip it over and it's like hitting the needle like that. We'll see about that. In any case, it is 12 minutes before the hour. Pretty good impression there. Iranian opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi is calling for a day of mourning and protest tomorrow. The rallies are dedicated to those killed while protesting the official presidential election results. At least 7 have died in clashes between demonstrators and security forces. Official results said Mousavi lost in a landslide to Ahmadinejad. The son of Iran's former Shah is also speaking out. Reza Pahlavi, who now lives in America, says it's time for the world to pay attention to what the people of Iran are saying.
The young generation has had it. They are risking their lives on the streets of Iran to demonstrate to the regime that they're not going to take it anymore, but also telling the whole world, hey, what are you going to do?
Among young protesters, several members of Iran's national soccer team, they wore green armbands on the field in a World Cup qualifying match in South Korea. That's the color worn by Mousavi supporters and waved in flags in protests. John and Femi.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Health industry groups are expected to deliver specific plans to the White House today.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their healthcare from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
All week long, we've been talking about healthcare reform. And healthcare reform is not simply a matter of spending federal dollars or changing insurance programs and reshuffling the paperwork that pays for the healthcare that all of us receive. It involves changing behavior of patients and doctors. Recently, lawmakers have been looking at Grand Junction, Colorado, as a model that improves the quality of care and cuts cost by changing the behavior of patients and doctors. The Dartmouth Atlas, a 20-plus-year project that examines the wide variation in Medicare use and costs across the U.S., has ranked Grand Junction, Colorado, is one of the most efficient areas in the whole country. And joining us to talk about the Grand Junction model is one of the town's medical leaders, Dr. Michael Primenko. He's a family physician and serves on the Colorado Medical Society's Congress for Healthcare Reform. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with one feature of Grand Junction, Colorado. I want to ask you about this. Is the efficiency in Grand Junction because most people or more people use primary care physicians rather than going directly to a specialist for their health care needs?
Yeah, I do believe that's a significant facet of why things operate well here is a focus on primary care. There's no question that's part of the equation.
How much of that behavioral change involved doctors coming together and patients being re-educated to change their focus?
Well, it's been a process ongoing now for about 30 years. This particular relationship has been going on for that amount of time, and that's probably how things kind of developed over time. And then, you know, we were fortunate to be highlighted because of some of these successes. So there wasn't this one point in time in the last 5 or 10 years where we all went out and said, hey, we got to change our behavior. This has been fostered through this relationship that we've had out here with a payer and with the local physicians and the medical community for about 30 years. And so it's developed over time.
All right. If I go out of my office here in Manhattan, in New York City, if I walk, north, south, east, or west, I run into a hospital. Some would say some of the best hospitals in the world are
right
here in New York. If I get sick in this city, I know what the narrative is going to be. How would it be different if I get sick in Grand Junction, Colorado? How different would my experience be?
Well, that's an excellent question. Let me first state that in the economics of healthcare, it doesn't quite work the way widgets work or gasoline. I sometimes tell people that, you know, if you put 4 gas stations up on the corner, you'll drive the price down. If you put 4 hospitals on the corner, you're going to drive the cost up. You know, hospitals and physicians will stay busy. They'll find a way to do it. With the way healthcare works, there's always a way to do it. And so if you have an oversupply, whether it's perceived or real, more likely a real oversupply, you're going to have greater cost in medicine. And what Dartmouth Atlas has pointed out, as you increase cost and begin to overuse medicine, your quality begins to suffer because of the downside of treating people too much. There is a cost to that, and there's a quality concern with that.
All right. So I'm new to Grand Junction, Colorado, Dr. Primenko. Mm-hmm. I want that CAT scan. I really need that MRI. I want to feel better by getting those X-rays. Give me that prostate test. I really need to know that I'm okay.
Right.
How do you convince me that that's actually the wrong path?
You're touching on an incredibly important point of healthcare reform and the part that patients own here. And doctors own a significant part, but you're touching on the importance of what the patients own. And that's where if you have a relationship with a physician, whether it's a primary care physician that you get to know over time or a physician that maybe a specialist that you know well. If you have a relationship with a physician that fosters better decision-making, a relationship of trust, then you can both sit down and you can say, hey, you know, here's what the studies show. If we just do this, treat you with some medicine, we're going to do pretty well. If you don't have that relationship and that trust isn't there, you're much more likely to want that extra procedure, and the doctor's much more likely to give it to you simply because, and that's what happens in the emergency room every day, is physicians, you know, oftentimes don't have the knowledge, underlying knowledge of a patient from 5-10 years earlier,
right.
And they do have to do all those studies. So I think the difference between, you know, in a big city versus here is oftentimes that relationship and rapport that's built up with a physician over time. Of course that happens in the big city, but in a culture of medicine where there's this, where you do develop a really good relationship with a primary care physician, you can make better decisions as you try to find your way through the forest of healthcare. There's so many decisions that can be made.
Well, some of this is going to involve patients paying higher costs up front, but less over time, and we don't have time to really get into that. But I heard a great story last night on NPR, the program All Things Considered, which profiled a community that's wealthy, that is pretty hip to healthcare, but when they put together a voluntary program that was very low cost for people to have precisely the relationships you're talking about, only 6% of the people signed up. It's hard to get people mobilized to change their behavior. Do you believe mandates are going to be the only answer here?
I think it's part of the answer, and one of the reasons why I'm sitting here talking to you is the message needs to be sent out to folks across the nation that if we're going to save this system, because as you pointed out in the lead-up and introduction to this program, cost is the key. If you're a fan of universal health care, you're a fan of cost control. If you're a fan of even things staying the same and being able to do exactly what we're doing now, you're a fan of cost control. The only people that aren't fans of cost control are people that don't believe in the safety net and want to see the system fail. So if you want cost control, you, the patient, along with me, the doctor, are going to have to change our behaviors and what we expect and how we deliver and receive our health care.
A great manifesto there from Dr. Michael Promenko for change in behavior as a prelude for reforming the entire healthcare system. Thanks so much for speaking with us. Dr. Michael Promenko is a family physician and serves on the Colorado Medical Society's Congress for Healthcare Reform in Grand Junction, Colorado, where they have certainly changed their behavior and realized the cost savings.
So you have been sending us your sound all this morning. Not any old sound, but sound that you love and you've missed from the past. We're taking part in a project with the BBC, Creating Endangered Sounds. So you can find all the instructions on how to do this at thetakeaway.org. Of course, we will air some of your ideas next week and some of your sound samples next week. What should be in our museum of the stuff we left behind?
This is Lorraine Arnett, and I'm calling from Florence, South Carolina. What I miss is teacher's chalk on a blackboard. The clack and squeak of chalk on a blackboard in a teacher's classroom.
These are brilliant. These are so brilliant.
That's really good. Although I've got hairs standing up at the back of the neck. Go to our website at thetakeaway.org and upload your endangered sounds while you're there. It's been a fun morning. Thank you very much, Mr. Cleverington.
We've got Cleverington here. We've got to do those sounds, though, every day next week.
Those
are great. Absolutely. I think they're fantastic. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi Okay. Ooh, this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.